Welcome. There we go. Welcome to Serotalk Tech Chat 74, whatever today is, September 23rd, 2010. This is Michael Loff. Joining me tonight on our topic of radio, we're going to talk about all things radio in one form or another. We have Tate Luck, who has had a pretty extensive career in the broadcast industry, and we're going to talk about, among other things, kind of what it takes to work in broadcasting today. Also joining me is Bill Sparks, who will give us another perspective, and that's broadcasting on the internet. He has, in addition to his podcast of All Things Radio, which I think they're up to number 78 as far as their podcast, which would mean they've been on weekly for about a year and a half. But also Bill runs Legend Oldies, and he's got your, what do you call that thing, Bill? I know you're just kind of in the midst of changing the format of it, so you're kind of... Right, to bringing that up. And you also have an OTR station, so we'll talk about broadcasting on the internet. And Bill also has BillSparks.org, which is a resource for thousands of radio stations on the internet. So we'll also talk about how to find radio stations online, some of the websites and portals for doing that. So we'll also take your questions a little bit later in the presentation. Tate, I'm going to ask you to kind of give us a quick overview of your career because I have to go down and turn down my monitoring setup here. But we are broadcasting. Absolutely. You are broadcasting live from the home of Bill and Jennifer Sparks in Indianapolis. So this is our first time kind of doing this in a remote situation where their couch is my bed and their end table is my studio slash office here. But so Tate, you started in radio in 13 of the what I used to call the big 10-watt giant. So kind of give an overview and then we'll talk about some of the specifics of radio.
Yeah, I started back when I was 13 years old in 1983. And we worked at a little college radio station outside of Burlington, North Carolina called WSOE. And they were just it's a college station. I just went and hung around because I was so interested in it. And I got my chance in like June of 83. And I don't remember my first song on the radio, but I remember the second one. I was too nervous to remember the first one. The second one was David Bowie, China Girl. So that's the second song I ever played in my life. But after that, I went around a couple of AM stations and did a couple of FM, the Top 40, 98.7 Kiss FM back in the day. Now it's called the I think it's called Simon FM in Greensboro, North Carolina. Also a country station, which is now Jazz slash Talk. Then I went to college at that point and majored in radio television and over in Gastonia, Dallas, North Carolina, which is right outside of Charlotte. And then from Charlotte, I actually went to programming WNOW, which was a Christian station in Charlotte, and I programmed that for a little while, and then went over and helped launch WRCM, which is on the air now, still today. Did that in like June of 93, and then left after about a year or so there, went over to Raleigh-Durham and worked. So I did a lot of North Carolina hopping until about 95, and then I became program director of the first ever full-time, it's funny, Christian rock station. Which made me laugh. Radio U in Columbus, Ohio, which is still on the air today, too. Programmed that for like 4 years. Then worked for Clear Channel, which actually was funny. Bill, I did the very first, one of the first ever online Christian music stations for Clear Channel. And did that for about a year and a half until they decided to pull the plug on the whole project of all their online stations. They were about 5 years too early, and you guys talk about that a little bit later. But then I went back to Columbus, Ohio again, and I programmed 104.9 The River in Columbus for about 6 years until about 2006 or seven. I came here, then moved down to Nashville, Tennessee, and then for a couple of years was the national program director for WayFM Media Group, which we had like 13 O&Os, and we also were satellite affiliates that ran our satellite program, which I was over, which is about 115 stations. And here we are today. The help?
Yeah, so let's...
They give you no time to turn down the mic.
I got it pretty quickly, actually. Thank you, sir. Let's... I'm trying to figure out where to start here. There's quite a few things there. I think first is interesting because you were involved... with The Way, right, which is a network of Christian radio
Way
stations,
FM, yes.
But Way FM, which
yes, sir.
A gentleman that I worked with, who called himself Skipper T.
Skipper T, yes, right. He lives down here again.
So he's down in Tennessee. We worked together at WRTB for 4 years maybe before he went to Fort Myers, Florida, started the first, I think it was WAYJ 88.7, and
that's
so
right.
Then you were, he hired you. So it is interesting that our paths did cross, and Skip was always open to blind broadcasters and treated everybody equal and very good guy. The guy could talk your ear off when it came to radio, so that was
interesting. I mean, it's always funny because he always, whenever we go on, it's funny you talk to him, he sounded like, he had a high voice anyway. We go on the air, it's like, CRT on WKBR. Yeah, it's just like really high. I can't do it anymore. I'm too old to be doing voices that high. But he could just, it was amazing how high he get in his pitch, and it was pretty funny.
Okay, so I got quite a few questions to ask you. I guess, first off, you said you put a radio station on the air in Charlotte. Talk about that process, because we went in, what they used to call, we blew up a radio station. We basically came in one day and just brought in our albums and took it over. But what is it like to put a new station on the air? What does that involve? I mean, how long were you there before the station actually went on the air? And talk about
that. I started in February of 93, and we launched in June. So I was there about 4 months, you know, with putting music in the automation system back then. We were getting everything together. It was a whole bunch of stuff. I built all the imaging, imaging pieces, sweepers, promos. That went on the air, the launch of the day. We a lot of thoughts about how to launch it. There's a lot of this process and strategy and thoughts to go through launching a station from scratch. It had never been on the air before. This is a brand new frequency at 91.9 in Charlotte. And so it was never used before. So that was also another challenge because no one knew you existed. You know, and unless they get through osmosis, you know, it's hard. You have to do some marketing. So we had to figure out how to do that and billboards and all the stuff that goes along with that. And that was a very fun process. I did the same thing. I went to Columbus for Radio U. We also had a brand new frequency on 88.7, never been on the air before. And that was a fun launch. We went on the air and tested it a lot of times before the FCC would give us full license. And that was always fun because people would be calling, like, what are you? We found Joe Descanon and stopped on the station. And that's just, it was always kind of cool to figure out what, that was always fun to do. And then what I did a very similar thing you did when you went and blew up a station. I went to WCVO in Columbus back in 2001, and we virtually kind of blew it up and relaunched it as 104.9 The River. So I've done a little bit of both of those.
So what was that like working for Clear Channel? I mean,
that was back when Clear Channel had more money than brains. And I say that very nicely because the fact is they sunk $50 million into this project before they decided, oh, we're not making any money at this. So they pulled the plug. And that's so, when their stock went from like, they gave me stock at $61 a share. And in about 4 weeks after I got the stock, it never went over, I never seen it go over higher than 39. So there you go. Since then.
But, I mean, talk about that experience. I was a program director at a very different time. I left in 93. There were a few, but most stations were still live. You came into it at a time when it was all computerized. You had voice tracking. It was heading that way.
Right.
I mean, by the time you were in Columbus and certainly by the time you started 104.9 The River.
Oh, yeah.
So talk about that process. Okay. You know, how long it took you to put together your show and the whole voice tracking. Just what you did as a program director.
Well, as a program director, a lot of what responsibilities are simplified a little bit. You're called a program director, really, is a simple way of saying he's a brand manager. Your brand is 104.9 The River. It's New Life 91.9 WRCM. And you're being a brand manager, you're in charge of a lot of the overall, like the sound of the station. You're in charge of all the air personalities, you're in charge of all the music decisions. I mean, you have a music director, but you and him work together, and you make the final call because it's your responsibility at the end of the day. Also, dealing with some marketing, you had a promotions director at most stations I had, and their job was to get out and find ways to let people know that we exist. And sometimes when you went to like in commercial atmosphere with 104.9 The River, which was commercial, we had to deal with remotes and a whole bunch of other sales-oriented promotions, which is not always my favorite because they didn't always line up what we're trying to accomplish, but you know how that goes. You guys have been, Mike, you were probably working on a commercial station, so you know sometimes you did things like, why are we here? Well, they pay us a big check.
Well, see, and I worked in a very small market. It was very different. You did that, right? The promotions, the on-air talent, if you had problems, you dealt with if you had upset clients, strife between sales and broadcast announcers. I don't know how that worked in the non-com space. but
not as bad, but it does get like commercial. I remember my sales manager in Columbus at 104.9 The River, him and I got to several knockdown drag out moments about how I believe that we shouldn't be doing this. He actually decided that he was going to try to sell. He wants to carry a college football on Saturday, which had nothing to do with what we're trying to accomplish.
But we had that as well, and there was a college station, and our GM wanted to do it. But we also needed the money for some advertisers. So you make that decision, well, I'm going to let 1% of my programming go to running these games for that quarter or whatever, because you know, it's some revenue. It's a small town thing, and it's always a tough. But I'm curious, you know, in the Clear Channel space, kind of what
Clear Channel was a very different animal, because they were still trying to figure out what to do with internet radio. They really wanted to be there.
Did you have choice in the music, or was that pretty much
produced? Oh, yeah. No, I did that because it was experimental. And they had no other Christian properties when I was programming Christian music. So they let me have my own head. Now, they had a few other stations they were a little, on the internet they were a little more controlling of. But the whole point of the internet project was called it was CCIG at the time that I worked for. Their whole concept was to put things on the internet you just don't get on FM or AM very, very much or hard to find. So it wanted to be kind of a niche. The problem is the internet wasn't mature back then, and so they really had a lot of great ideas, but with way too early timing, and they pulled the gun way too quick. I mean, they really should have. If they would have stayed another 2 years in that plan, they probably would have dominated and actually had a nice presence today. The problem is they were way too early. And Clear Channel, of course, is a typical corporate. You had all the, you know, I remember one time where the human resource people flew into town and in Nashville here and sat down with us, and I laughed because they hand out these the manuals and the policy manuals, and they actually had a separate one for sexual harassment that was 25 pages long, just for that one topic. And I was like, wow.
I had to cover their bases, but in that case, probably not just coworkers, but even callers. I don't want to go into detail. I had an issue with someone who said something a little suggestive to a caller. So we probably dealt with that fun stuff. But I'm just curious.
The program director's job is to go in and take care of that and make sure that the bear personality is doing what they're supposed to do, representing the station correctly.
So at some point, pretty recently, but the whole, our jobs were based on listeners. And if our ratings fell, but maybe if they fell, but we still had good advertisers, we kept our work. But one way or another, if either of those started to sink, we were out of work. But pretty recently, 2 years ago, we switched to got away from the Arbitron Diaries and this whole PPM, or I call the one-eyed, one-horned flying personal people meter. you know, so talk about this new way that is used to determine or guess how many people are listening, and maybe what some of the deficits are. Explain how it works.
Let me give you a little backstory, because Arbitron had a thing called the diary methodology for a long time, and the diary methodology was all based on top of mind. So, in other words, if you remember listening to the station, you wrote it down. You remember listening to it for 20 hours a day, you wrote it down 20 hours a day, whatever you did. It was all memory. And keep in mind, we barely can remember what we actually had for lunch, let alone what stations listened to throughout the day. Because nobody ever filled it out. They always filled it out like right when they needed to send it back over the last week. So a lot of stations would get what they call phantom QM, or people listening that really did not listen as much or got it confused. Where I love looking at the diary comment section, right, or how they described your station. And at the river, it was like, I remember several times it was 92.3 The River. Now, that was a country station, WCOL, in Columbus. So you see all kinds of different ways to write it down. You get half credit, they called it. So it was all a top-of-mind diary. That's why it was very important to remind people that you existed. Well, Arbitron's like, well, this methodology is, you know, getting old. It doesn't really represent what really should be going on. So they came up with this thing called the personal people meter, PPM meters. And what it is, they actually get a panel of people. And like in New York City, they have 4,000. I think in Columbus, they're doing 1,500. Nashville, I think, is like 1,200. Now, these 1,200 people represent all the listeners in one market. And what happens, they share this little box around with them that looks like kind of a oversized pager, which, you know, isn't very stylish, but hey. But when they walk around and they hear stations, the when listening to stations in their car, or they're walking by someone else listening to a radio station, or walking to a business that has one on, their meter picks up a signal that has been implanted actually in the FM or AM transmitting, and even internet now. Actually, they have them on the internet too. So if you're listening to the station on the internet and you have a PPM, you count it to listen to that. You're getting counted as a listener to that station. And what's the difference? It took the whole top of mind thing away, and it actually shows actual listening measurements. It's a whole different methodology, and a lot of people do not like it because they can't manipulate it as easily by doing things on the air or making big stinks and getting the paper. For example, and also it's not nice to a lot of the ethnic population. For example, Mega in New York, when they first had their first book, they went from number 3 in the market to number 14. And they're like, what? So they thought it was really bad. And what's come to find out, the Latino market, the Spanish market in New York, or Asian market, the Latino market in New York, kept spitting in the diary back in the old write down the what you listen to pages. They kept writing down Mega, but in reality, they were listening to Hot 97, Z100, the other big stations in town. And that's what the PPM actually shows, the real truth of what's going on. And it's good in some ways and bad in others.
Now, you said something about a station in New York that might be 4,000 people meters out, but 35 of them are really less than 1%.
Oh, yeah. Let's just do CBS FM. I just actually had a chance last week or 2 weeks ago to meet with Brian, their program director. I was down at a convention in Orlando. And when I was down there, Brian and I got a chance to talk, and he was telling me that, you know, what's funny about it is they might have only 35 meters at any given time listening to the station, but that represents their whole audience. But that audience represents like 4 million people listening is what it equates to, is the way the measurements go. It seems a little far-fetched, a little weird, but they have a whole statistics methodology behind it, which would give us all a headache if I actually knew it. It actually could break it down to the infinite detail. But to keep it on the surface level, yeah, you might see Morning Drive show 9 meters listening. Or you might show, because actually what's the difference is the old diary days, you got a report, a little trend report once a month, and you got what they call the full book every 3 months. Well, the diary is totally different the PPM is totally different because you get a little trend report each week and you get a book each month. So you get 13 books a year, where you used to only get 4. So it's a whole bunch more information and a lot more real time. So it gives a lot of the program directors a chance to actually make changes if they need to, or move things around if they need to, that kind of deal.
So talk about, at some point, they wised up and saw the power of social networking, Facebook, Twitter, MySpace. Kind of, when did that come into play, and when did those become requirements, and what does a program director, even on-air talent, have to be mindful of now that they didn't in the past, or we didn't?
Well, the program director job has started to evolve a little bit over the last 3 years, and they're actually becoming more of a media savvy person also. And that's like, you know, having Facebook fan pages for their station or even their air talent. It makes sure the air talent is very conscious of keeping it updated and reacting. And a lot of the air talent do like it. I mean, Wally at WayFM hates Facebook. I mean, he hates it with a passion, but he understands the value of it, so he still does it, but he complains about it. But then Brant, the morning guy, on the other hand, Brant, he loves it, he embraces it, he's always Twittering, he's always putting some on Facebook, and it's become the fact that it gives you a chance to interact with a certain amount of your audience. It's not your whole audience. It's like, you know, like your whole audience never calls in. The myth about radio is that everybody calls into a radio station. No, in reality, only about 2% of people ever will call a radio station and listen to it. So maybe 2 out of every 100 people listening will actually call the station.
At best, and that's even, schools closed or, you know, something major is going on where they need to know what, 2% at best.
Or to call and say, Michael, can I hear Michael Jackson one more time, Black or White?
Exactly.
I was trying to find a song back when you played radio, when you were on the radio playing stuff.
Yes, those were the tunes. What was the big one? MC Hammer, Can't Touch This.
Oh, that's right. That was back.
And that was one of those I held out on playing, but it just had so many requests, you know. Or
Can't Touch This.
Can't Touch This.
Yeah, I hate it because it had a cold intro.
Right. Talk about some of the promotions and things you did to get listeners.
Okay. Well, and Columbus was always fun because that's my favorite time. I had a great time working at 104.9 The River. We did a lot of things because we were a Christian station. Our focus was to present a presence on the air of a higher power, something more important than our own selves, is what the whole higher concept was. But to drill that down a little bit, we really were about the people helping people. And one of the promotions, my favorite one of all time, and it's worked out beautifully. We actually got, who was it? I think it was one of the malls there. I can't remember which one it was now, Polaris or somewhere, to give us like three $1,000 gift cards. And we're having the meeting, the typical concept is, well, just give away $1,000 each week, and people can register online or whatever. You know, and that sounds you know, very self-serving. And so what I wanted to do was something a little different. I want to have a different approach and think outside the box. And so I said, why don't we do this? Why don't we actually have the 3 weeks like we talked about, but instead of the person getting the whole $1,000, they get $500 of it, and they can take the other $500 and give to a family in need this Christmas. And that turned into a huge deal for us. It was our best, my best book ever. We had a 4.2, 12 plus on the ratings, and we were like fourth in women, 25. It was really pretty amazing time. And what was interesting about it was, out of the three people who won, only one took it for themselves. The other two gave both $500 gift cards to families in need.
Oh, that's awesome.
That was a very cool promotion.
You had me beat there. I never did anything that creative. I remember once we had tickets and backstage passes for Metallica, and the callers had to tell us when they did the Unforgiven. So they had to be a little creative on the, of course, that was you know, top 40 rock radio. So
you want to tell us some of those stories on the air? No, I'm just kidding.
Well, they were probably made up, because then it was a, you know, they had to fabricate a little bit. But
I got you.
I remember one that was really big during the war in Iraq, and we had this thing. I think it was kind of a national campaign. We had this morning when at 9 o'clock we told everybody to record and make a tape. And then we sent all these tapes to soldiers over there. Yeah, that was really cool.
Yes, I remember. I was actually in radio then. I don't remember that. And yep. Actually, Styx had a song that kind of went along with that too at the time. I think it was Styx.
Yeah, there was quite a few songs. I remember a gentleman told me that, wow, when you played Genesis Land of Confusion, it just fit the bill. I remember that.
I remember that too. That's one thing cool about radio, and it was what always attracted me to it was always that the like mystery of it. You know, the mystery of radio. What was also cool, was attracted me to it, is the fact is that you can see it really affect people. The songs you play, the music you play, the personalities. I mean, everybody, it's funny, everybody criticizes Howard Stern, for example, but Howard Stern, he accomplished something in radio no one's ever still been able to do. He had more people hate him, listen to him every day, than actually loved him. He kept both sides of the coin going.
Yeah, I found that very, very fascinating, because it went beyond the music. You had to interact with people. And it was always interesting, because you could almost say anything until you upset an advertiser. Then you had to go in and explain yourself. Otherwise, it was pretty much, you know, almost anything goes, I mean, within reason. So, Bill, do you have any questions over there before we talk to you a little bit about the whole side of internet broadcasting? Anything you want to throw in here?
Well, not really, with the exception I remember Clear Channel when we first started doing the website, how challenging it was to capture the link so that people could listen to the level you could go to just to get the links.
Right, because the blind community, of course, it's expanded now. It's a mainstream website, but people wanted to play them in standalone Windows Media or WinApp, and we were one of the first to do embedded web page players, which a lot of folks do now with Java or Flash, you know, Silverlight, what have you, just to make sure that they can, if nothing else, track and see how long people are staying, or are they clicking on the ad. So that's always an interesting facet there. Oh, definitely. So,
hey, Mike.
Yes.
I have one more thing I wanted to bring up, if I could.
Oh, sure.
Because something that everybody always asks me, I just find it pretty fascinating. It can be a quick 2-minute deal.
Okay.
Is how do we decide what songs to play?
That is a good question, because, you know, I would literally, I'll tell my experience, and I'm curious how you did it. I was music director for 2 years and pro PD for another two, and like you said, was really involved in music, so for those 4 years. But, you know, I would just get the music in, and I would go through and listen, and just things would grab me. That's where I got to use my musical, you know, just the ability to kind of pick out songs, but I also had a DJ business, and I would go out and play things and kind of watch the reaction of the crowd. I go to record stores and talk to them and find out what kind of music people were buying, although you had to watch that because a lot of times the people buying music weren't necessarily the ones listening to your radio station. Or you'd give away things and you'd kind of see what level of interest was there. And you would use request lines to an extent, realizing that only 2% on a good day of your audience would actually call in. But if you played a song and females started calling. What was the one? I remember Black Velvet by Alanna Miles, because I just became music director, and I thought, wow, that, you know, the phones were rocking, you know, so I knew there was something to this song. And but I'm curious how you tapped into it. Of course, the internet brings a whole new element to it that we didn't have, and that's the right. fact that if you play a song, you instantly see people tune out. I remember I was testing back in 98 and playing different songs. I had quite a few listeners, and I think I put on, you know, the Rupert Holmes Pina Colada song and lost over half the audience. So that's something that we never had. I mean, you just threw it out there, and you didn't know what you were working with. So talk about how that changes versus when you started in the 90s versus what you can do today to track that.
Well, back when I first started, it was very rudimentary. We didn't have money at any place I worked at to do anything like an auditorium test, which is a test where they bring people of a certain demographic in and play them like 400 hooks, and they rate the songs, and that's how a lot of stations got their basic playlist. And they pay them like $50 a person to come in and do that. So, we do about 100, 150 people. Couldn't afford that back then. So, really, a lot of it was instinct and gut up to about 1998, and then I started dabbling in online research, and that started looking interesting. When I went to Clear Channel, we didn't, of course, have money for research, but when I went back to Columbus back in 2001, that's when the whole thing turned around. That's when research started, what I call it, started driving the bus. And what we'd find out is that what people would tell us on the phones, what people were telling us in person, wasn't always what the research came back and showed us. Because what we built the research on is people who are what they call preference one or P1 type people who love the radio station and adore the station. They're super core listeners. And we would actually build a internet base of these people through promotions and just, you know, ask people to join the River Music team and do all that. We started, it was pretty amazing because then you started seeing how certain songs would, you know, test longer than others. They would all have a different life. It totally opened your eyes in how music is looked at. And you find out also really quickly that, you know, even though people tell you all day long, I want variety. I need more variety. Variety is what I want. You know, better mix. And what would you find out in reality? They really don't want a better variety. What they really want in reality, in actionable research, they want the song. You play the songs they love right now.
Exactly.
And that's what it boils down to. So my playlist in Columbus was about 136 songs. Not because I wanted to play 136 songs. It's just what tested well enough to be played.
Yeah, and I can't hold with a station like that, but a lot of people do because they're listening right. very short periods of time as they travel from point A to point B. Or
average listener's about 22 minutes a day in certain markets. Now, small the market, it seems to be a little bit less and longer depending on what market it is, but bigger. It, like with longer commutes, you get a little bit longer listening.
Right. So if you have people commuting in from the suburbs into an urban right. area or something, like even in Columbus versus
right. Columbus average commute was 20 minutes each way. That was average, or 18 minutes each way, I think is what the research showed. And so, yeah, you average, that's only about 40 minutes a day of listening. So to get them to hear a certain song enough times, you had to play it about, you know, 50 times a week.
So what was effective to actually get people to listen at certain times? And a lot of stations gave away cash. My friend Danny Wayne worked for Midwest Broadcasting. They did this whole thing. They used the website and did this whole thing with reward points and actually found that it worked.
Oh,
for
the
them.
Clubs, yeah.
Yeah, the clubs.
You do that too. The clubs are actually not a bad idea. The station out here doesn't really big the fish. They're really big about the club thing, the fish club. And when they do that, it's kind of bad. It's kind of a good idea, but the problem is only a small percentage.
Exactly. Only a very small percentage participates in that.
Let's be generous and say 8 out of 100 listen. 8 of them out of 100. So you have, in reality, you have 92 people who really don't give a flip about what you're talking about for the next 2 minutes. And I think that's where the danger comes in.
Or someone would say, well, I'm going to talk about this, but, well, it's already been Twittered and Facebook, and so everybody knows about it. But that's a wrong assumption.
No,
it's completely opposite. Like yesterday, you know, when he said, if Steven Tyler and Jennifer Lopez are going to be the new judges on American Idol, I mean, you run with it because you can't assume that everybody knows that. And so,
are you taking it one step further? Get the listeners' reactions to that on the air.
Exactly.
You say, yeah, okay, hey, call right now, 821-9292. What is your thoughts? Is this the right pay people? Do you think they're really going to make the show totally a different dynamic?
Well, you watch it because of them. Yeah. You know, a lot of people watched it and quit. Will you actually tune in to see Steve or Jennifer?
Or if you're a lifetime person, you say, nope, Simon's gone. Paula's gone, I'm gone. If it works both ways. So, yeah, I think you're right. I mean, if you listen to like Ryan Seacrest, who a lot of people in the industry slam and say, oh, he's just a he's a horrible DJ. Honestly, Ryan Seacrest is probably one of the better ones, because the one thing about it is, it's not that he's spectacular and sparkles. He's very good because he's very consistent from day to day. And that's very important. That's what people like. People like people who are very consistent. You know, his flash in the pan stuff gets old after a while. I mean, the shock and awe stuff gets very old because you become very immune to it. And Ryan is just a level dude every day. He tries to be a real person on the air, and I really appreciate that about him.
Screensaver.
So let's talk about the ability to monetize internet streaming. I mean, I was there in the beginning. You know, I played all the way back in 97 when it kind of, the audio quality reminded me of a talking book record, and you had a few pop stations and news talk, and I had dreams about it sounding, and that's exactly the way it was at the time. But at what point they started to monetize it, you had the big, it was really set back, what was it, 02, when they said, well, you can't broadcast the ads. So stations had no technology to mute the ads. Right, so all these stations went off the air, and it took really a couple years to rebound from that. And now you have these systems that kind of work. A lot of stations have separate ads for their internet streams based over the air feed, and a lot of them that are a little kludgy, they don't quite work, or some that go silent. I listened to the Colts game last Sunday, and of course they just went silent during the breaks. How weird! I mean, you know.
I know, you never do that on FM.
Right, you would never do that on FM. But how is that working? What are we seeing? Are stations successfully monetizing their internet stream? Or what?
Well, the other problem was, too, along with the advertising, was that all of a sudden the RIAA decided they wanted more money, or wanted money from internet-only stations. So that became another big issue, too, along with the advertising. So you had two things hitting the internet. Radio on the early side. How about you, Bill? What do you think about that?
I agree. It was a challenge when we first started our online radio station. Then all of a sudden they talked about raising the rates, and we didn't know if we were going to be able to go to the next week. And we just figured out it. Round zero. We finally got to a point to where they never made money off. We made substantial inroads, but internet radio, especially starting from our position, I mean, it takes a long way to build up that listenership and credibility.
It takes a minimum of a year, and really longer, but it takes that first year to establish yourself and get rapport, and then there's the whole thing of, you know, a lot of stations have a peak during the business hours. Someone will listen to it in the office, and that's it. Or maybe you do a more modern rock or something more upbeat, and maybe you have more of an evening audience. But I was just curious, Tate, have you seen in your efforts of stations you've been with or know about how, if any, have monetized, or what the listenership is as compared with over the air?
Well, yeah, it's getting more and more, I will say that, over time, because you have more devices. I mean, you think about this, and here's something I think you appreciate, but I think you and Bill both appreciate this. The iPhone and the Android phones, all these are basically just transistor radios, and they're all right. Think about it, because you can listen to your radio station like you used to, put your radio under the pillow back 20, 30 years ago, a little bit of radio that's played radio. Now, your phone does a lot more, but you still can turn it into a transistor radio, so to speak. And that's where I think listenership is going up, because mobile devices is what's making it more easier for people to listen, especially in their car. I mean, I would love, my wife and I sometimes, that's a station I love to listen to, G105 in Raleigh, Durham, North Carolina. I love their morning show. And I listen to them once in a while. I always pop them on. My wife's BlackBerry. She'll just pull down the iHeartRadio app and pull up Juno 5, and I just plug it into the aux deal, and we're going down the road, down through Nashville listening to G105. And so I think that makes internet radio very possible, especially internet-only stations have a better chance to monetize over time. But it takes time to do that, like you guys say. Plus, the other challenge you run into, if I'm not mistaken, if I read the rules right, if you start making money with internet radio, you have to pay more royalties. Is that right?
Oh, that's exactly right. And yeah, the way the licensing is, as I learned, if you're involved with any kind of commercial entity, which is something I had to be very careful of, trying to put a station on, we have Samnet Radio as an arm of Serotech, but easily your fees could quickly go from, you know, $30 a month up to $3,000 a month, and it's really designed to kill or stifle or cripple internet-only stations. But I'm very excited, like you said, the evolution of iPhone and Android and BlackBerry at radio apps. So I wonder if by 2020 many stations could end up going off the air. I mean, literally, especially maybe first at AM. I mean, just being killed by this.
Well, here's a challenge you run into. They did a analysis in Chicago recently, and someone who's driving from the outer suburbs of Chicago to downtown, which is about an hour, 10-minute commute, if everyone who did that pulled up a radio station on their iPhone, whatever the mobile device they have, and listen, streamed it. If every person did that, all the networks, including AT&T, Verizon, everybody would crash. They can't handle that much. So unless the infrastructure is put into place over the next X amount of years with LTE and everything coming out, maybe it will be. But until it is, that stuff's going to be really hard to. I think FM still has a life ahead of it. I mean, maybe 15, 20 years still left. A good 15, 20 years still left. I think that AM is probably more on the cutting board right now, or the chopping block, better than anything else, because of the fidelity. I mean, it's amazing how you can talk to somebody who's 18 years old and go, so, you listen to AM? What's AM? They really don't know. They don't have a clue. And think about it. And even the iPod Nano that I have, it doesn't have AM radio on. It has FM only. So that's another reason why they don't know what AM is.
Well, even the teens aren't. Even the teens, I mean, they might play and dabble and fumble through FM, but really they're not. They're loading music on their devices and
right. And downloading Pandora.
And my son's driving around in his truck listening to Pandora. You know, so it's a different time.
Yeah, my wife does too. Makes me mad.
Yeah. But so I'm curious how that's going to affect radio. This whole concept of Pandora, Last.fm. Slacker,
yeah.
That Mike Calvo loves. I mean, this concept of you kind of choose your own station, build your own genre, do thumbs down, and eventually tweak it to play the stuff that you like. How is radio going to compete with that? I mean, it's going to take a while. You know, we're now on the cutting edge doing that, but it's taking
the
off.
Good news is, like Slacker, you have to get those really cool features, extra features. Like you can do a request on Slacker. I heard it plays 15, 30 minutes later. But those cost money. How much is a subscription to like Pandora or Slacker? I've never checked into the price. Is that 15, 30 bucks a month?
Oh, they're not that much. Do you know, Bill?
Okay. I thought about looking into
it. Pandora, you pay if you use more than 100 hours a month or something like that. And
yeah, some restrictions.
I looked. No, it was I want to say Slacker was something like 30 a year or something. And then what you could do is unlimited. You could skip an unlimited number of songs.
Yes, I did see that.
Otherwise, it was just like six an hour. So it wasn't anything too unreasonable. It's a question of how many people will pay for that privilege and capability.
It's funny you talk about it because there's another entity that is using internet now too, and they're finding out they have a lot of people listening more to the internet than they actually do the, satellite radio. Ah, Sirius and XM.
Because
they're finding out the fidelity of Sirius and FM are so bad, people just get tired of it, and they actually will stream. You download the XM app on iPods if you have a subscription. You can listen to the channels that Sirius has that you're already paying, or XM's you're already paying for, right there on your iPhone, and it sounds 10 times better.
Exactly. That's what I'm doing. It's funny you mention it. I was ready to drop it, but I tried it one more year and got the XMRO, the radio online.
Yeah.
And it does sound better than the radio itself, and I like it because it also shows me, before I click on the station, before I tap on it, what they're actually playing, so I can decide, do I want to go to that station?
Okay.
So that's the next evolution. I mean, right now, the internet's cool because you tune in a station, you see what's playing, but the fact to do it even before you tune in.
Have you downloaded the XM app for your iPhone?
Yeah, the XMRO. Yeah, I think that's what they call it. Yes, I've definitely got that. And
okay, good. It sounds like it must be accessible.
Oh, it's very accessible. Okay. Yes, indeed.
But Sirius and XM have a big problem ahead of them. They have a lot of debt load. Howard Stern's contract comes up this year. And that's going to be very interesting because Mel Karmson has made it very clear he's not signing another $500 million contract. That ain't going to happen. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. Satellite radio's got to figure out how to get an audience and keep it. A lot of people have dropped them.
Well, see, Stern has figured that out. Go to an internet only if he could find the infrastructure to handle that. But
that's a good point, too. He's got about $2 or $3 million a week and listen to him. Consistently. That's a lot of people.
Well, they would have to devise some system that actually shares. So basically, when you listen, it turns around and use your bandwidth to feed another person.
Okay. Gotcha.
You know, there are technologies like that. So basically, it's handed off, and that way you build a network. I do want to give a few minutes here to Bill to talk a little bit about. You have three stations. Of course, you use station playlists, which one of the new features we're getting ready to play with is they've just added the ability to do requests. So we're looking at that. But just talk about that process of kind of the basic maintenance of a station, and I'll leave you to kind of go where you will with that. There's a few others, Sam Broadcaster, that some folks are using, and of course, Paul Morrell is involved with that company. It's the app is unfortunately not as accessible, but allows greater advertising opportunities. But just talk about kind of what you're doing with the stations and kind of where you see that going.
Listeners, three listeners, whatever the case may be. And we had a few people who believed in what we wanted to do, and we started assembling the staff and gave people an opportunity to be in broadcasting who never would have gotten that opportunity before. And so we built up a staff over time and learned to use the playlist. And it brings a lot of people together who have never had that opportunity. It's not that people like Kate can do a great job, but these people wanted to do something for themselves.
They never got the opportunity to do it without the advent of internet radio.
Right, so you're seeing people who maybe worked in radio before, turning a career into a hobby, but also some people coming into this and turning a hobby, getting a little more serious about their hobby, and then maybe even going on into a career. I think of someone like Rachel Bader, who worked at ACB Radio Interactive and then worked at WNNS. I'm not sure if she's still there in Springfield, Illinois. So it's interesting that people are using the internet as their start, and it's always a challenge because, as we know, those of us in radio, we got a little bit of an ego. We have definitely strong opinions about what should be played, what should not be played, how the station should sound as far as sweepers and promos. And so it's always an interesting kind of a social thing to keep your staff and your team morale going, especially when they're volunteers and they can just wake up one day and go, I'm tired of this. It's time to move on. But you also have, a 24/7 model in place. So if someone gets tired, well, okay, I don't have a live 3-hour show, but I still got the music. What's that Grateful Dead song? The music never stops. So you just keep it moving.
Exactly right, and we really work hard, and we've been very, very fortunate and blessed that usually the same people that started out with us several years ago are still here. So obviously, hopefully, we're doing something right. We meet every week. Over things,
We still have our disagreements. I mean, you've seen that. It's just human nature. And maybe we're not as professional as we could be. We really tried. We really, I believe, put out a good product for, you know, we started with the blindness community, but we want anyone to listen to our stations. We don't care. We embrace anybody and everybody.
Well, but the internet radio to me brings a whole new paradigm because you start out, you have a theme, okay? So we're going to be oldies and we're going to be 60s, 70s. And now as we realize as time goes on, we bring in the 80s because, you know, every year you move forward, your audience is going to move a year forward in the types of music that they may want to hear. But just the fact that you can try different genres, you can say, well, I have an oldie station, but I'm going to throw in a podcast or I'm going to throw in a smooth jazz show and I'm going to try some different things. I know my peak hours. Maybe I don't do some of this stuff during the office listening hours, but I have these off hours or nights or weekends and I can kind of experiment and just see what happens. And it's, I think it's an exciting time. I think there's more creativity and freedom. And I just really wonder, it's going to be a while, as Tate said, a few years before the internet has the bandwidth in place. But I really wonder about the long-term viability of terrestrial commercial radio.
You know, it's a lot of fun. We put it together. We started the podcast about a year ago. Every Thursday night, we do about an hour, a little over an hour program. Several people getting together to put together a podcast with all things about radio. Format news, radio news, market scopes, features, air chats.
And I enjoyed your podcast. I actually like that podcast a lot.
Well, thank you. But we had fun doing it. And that learning your market scope. But
do you have any air checks, Tate? Maybe sometime we'll have to link to some air checks, buddy.
Yeah, I had to try to find something, man.
Oh, God, don't tell me like me, you didn't keep any. Now, some folks, I mean, I know people that had shoe boxes and closets full of tapes of everything they ever did. There was people like me that, right, would just, I might go home and listen to it once. I used to tape myself on VHS Hi-Fi. Remember that back in 85 when it was a new technology? And I was excited as a blind person, right? I figured out how to program that VCR to record me when, you know, midnight to 6 or whatever. Right. So things have really evolved. But I think we're going to open up here and take some questions from folks. Is there any other really important point, maybe something I didn't cover that you want to... What do you tell new people? You got maybe high school kids or young folks thinking about actually going into broadcasting as a career. Tate, what would you tell them right now?
That's a very good question. I've been thinking, but you've kind of asked me that a couple weeks ago, and I've been thinking about it a lot. And it's a really hard answer because radio is a whole different animal. And the problem that radio has is that they're not taking time to bring up new people as much as they used to. Used to, you'd pay your dues by going to an AM station, little small town AM station, and doing everything. You'd work overnight on the big FM station. You would do all these duties. Problem is, like, voice tracking, which is something that has come into play so much in the last couple of years, that it's actually killed a lot of those opportunities. And one of the things I was trying to do when I was at WayFM was to bring back that opportunity that Friday and Saturday night and Sunday night overnight will be live times for new people to start being trained and less, you know, less risk time. And but that, you know, I think the internet is giving you more of a possibility to start honing your skills. I like Bill Sparks station. There's a couple other stations out there that maybe let you do a show. But the important thing is to learn. I'm not sure if college is always the best thing. I mean, looking back on, I kind of wish I would have majored in English or something that I could actually take off. Because I walked out of college going, I have no idea. I knew more about radio when I walked in than I did when I walked out. And because they just don't teach the practicalities of it. They teach all the theories and all the, you know, all the history. I mean, I want to know about, you know, KDKO or KDKF and all these other radio stations. And it's just, it's a very interesting time, but I would encourage you to research it. Call people who are local in your local markets, like your station. Call the afternoon guy, midday girl, if they still have live people. That's always a challenge again, because almost every top 40 that is a top 40 has Ryan Seacrest now. So it's kind of hard to call him. But try to call somebody and see. That's how I did it. I used to call people all the time and bug the snot out of them. And wanted to know about radio and ask them questions, how they did this, that, and the other. That's a way to get into it. College will help you. If find a station, find a college that has a radio station. That will help a lot, too. But if you go to college and do it. But I would say just, you know, try to learn the market. It's really tough. It's going to be a tough time because they – radio's got to retrain. I think the internet is where the hope is to train new personalities for the future.
Definitely. I apologize. I received a question, but I am not seeing it on my screen, so you might try the F9 to voice that question. I apologize. Part of this, you talk about experimentation. That's what we're doing tonight. I'm out here with a laptop, and I got a Macintosh feeding Skype into it and a Tascam USB.
Okay,
where it's kind of, there you are. Jeff, go ahead, sir, with your question.
Yeah, my question was, and I want to thank you for having me on the show, Mike, is what about computer skills? With everything being computerized and someone trying to go into broadcasting, what would you recommend for that individual, and what kind of knowledge of computers are you recommending individuals have today?
Okay, Tate, is computer skills. What, Jeff Bennett asks, what do you need to have?
You need to know Windows, and honestly, radio does not do anything in Mac yet. So Mac is not, if you go get a Mac, you go, I know Mac now. Very few things. I think the only thing done in a Mac right now I know of in radio is probably Pro Tools, which is good. That's becoming more accessible. But learn Windows. Learn how Windows works. And the problem is you run into a lot of the automation software that you have to use on the air is not accessible. Like Station Playlist is one of the few that is, which I think is a very good program. But a lot of stations don't want to buy it because it's too cheap and they don't think it'd be dependable. There's a whole bunch of reasons. So they use bigger, very more expensive software like Scott Studios or actually now it's called Google Radio. Then there also is Next Gen, which is owned by Clear Channel, and a few other ones out there. OpDex is a program made by a company called BSI, who I'm good friends with the vice president of sales there. She's actually has asked me to test it to try to see if they can make it more accessible for blind individuals, which I appreciate them doing that.
So what about the concept of voice tracking? I mean, what does that take? Can you do that, or what?
It depends on the system. Like I said, like for example, Scott Studios, I never could figure out how to get it to go to the next break. Because it was all mouse-driven. They could not figure out how to write a keyboard command. I did not understand that even till this day. So what I'd have to do is bring my APD or somebody in the building or an intern in with me, and what they would do is just basically I would hit do the space bars and everything, do all the things to start and track, walk it up, but they would actually just hit the button, hit the mouse key that would actually go to the next break. So, I mean, so it all depends on what's going on. So you definitely need sighted help, unfortunately. I mean, I know I'm always one of the ones who wants to be as independent as possible. I don't need any help from anyone. But in this day and time, because computers are changing so much, and no one really has a clue how to help visually impaired people out, you have to really help educate them as you go along and be patient with them.
For a totally blind person, what role or importance does Braille skills play?
It's good to have. I mean, I'm a poor guy, so I've never owned a Braille printer, even though I wanted to really bad, but I just could never find $4,000 to plop down on one. And so I've never had a Braille printer or a Braille display, which, I mean, I would have loved to have had one, but that would be helpful if you could print. If you had a Braille printer, you could print out, like, your copy for if you're doing a spot read, or you're doing or sort of live copy, for example. That's becoming very popular again, by the way. Live copy, could get more money for it. You're on there reading a spot live. Also, it'd be good to have the playlist because you can print that out in Braille. It'd be great to have. Know what's coming next. You can find yourself on the screen a little easier. And it's just a lot of Braille would not hurt you at all. It does not hurt. You just got to have the equipment to make it work.
Do you use it, though? When I worked in radio,
I never did. No.
Pre-computer, I used Braille. I mean, I used an Opticon to literally read my log of the ads that I had to run. And we didn't, the music wasn't computerized. It was old school. You know, everything was kind of in different rotations. you know, everything was categorized by letter, but also right to read. We had 10-second live things to read. I read sports scores in the morning, right? So I mean, I had to use Braille, and I had to at that time use an Opticon. I'm sure all that's different now, but
I used a lot of memory. I just tried to memorize it, and actually, but again, I was also about free flowing, so I always put it in my own words. Yeah, I would do that usually on the side.
But I mean, we had to read a lot of things verbatim. I don't know how you would read. If you memorize sports scores, you're a better man than I. I couldn't do that. I had to have it in front of me and read it through once, and then, you know, I could spit it out and sound professional and didn't sound like I was reading it. And, you know, and I know the computer's changed the whole paradigm. I'd have to believe it's still important somewhere. What, Bill?
I was just going to say, memory used to it.
Yeah, exactly. But I got in my late 40s, and memory's not what it was.
Yeah, I was about to say, as I get older, my memory is not near what it was 15, 20 years ago.
Get the gecko or ginkgo or whatever it is.
I eat some 5-hour energy at least twice a day.
Coffee, whatever. Well, that was, you know, when I was program director, I had both. I had people that come in and knew a lot, but they had egos to go with it. And then I'd find people who were young and eager and didn't, but welcome. And I would teach, I would work with them one-on-one and built some of the finest broadcasters that I had the honor to work with. And I was, you know, I felt good doing that. And some of them went on to some great things. And, you know, that was rewarding in its own way. So it's all on where you are. If you're into that, some people aren't. It's want to bring people in with the skills. But as blind and visually impaired folks, we have to have the skills. I mean, we already have a leg against us there, and we're going to have to come in, be on our game, help us have a good voice, have some good production skills. Do you do stuff like that, SoundForge, or you mentioned
Pro Tools?
Sonar?
Okay. Yeah, I have some. Let's see here. I can probably I can play this 10-second thing here. I produced.
Okay, go ahead.
Top of Grand Indonesia Shopping Town.
This is Jakarta's best mix.
95.1 KISS FM.
There you go. It's not my voice, but I produced everything around it.
Oh, so what are you doing now? You said you oversee 13 stations for the Way Network? Is that what you said? Where are you?
Yeah, I was actually until about a couple months ago, they actually had as the economy goes, a reduction in force, and I guess I was making too much money because they brought somebody in a little bit. They redid the job a little bit and brought a different person in, and so I'm actually not with Way FM at this time, which I was a couple months ago. So it's been a couple of months, and I'm actually what they call on the beach looking for the next gig. It's been tough though. It's a whole different era. This is the first time I've actually not worked full time in radio since '93.
Wow, so after 17 years straight. Right. Okay.
It's been really crazy. I think I was when Clear Channel let us go, I was out of work for about 1 month, I guess. But it really didn't count because I was already doing stuff anyway. But that was back in 2001. But I've been very, very blessed to be able to do that. This has been the first time I've been on the beach, and it's changed, though. It's a whole different matter.
Well, let me ask you, what do you think you'll do? I mean, I worked in radio, and finally, I had a DJ business. I started a business called Teletalk, where I provided information over the phone. Until that, their internet came along. I worked at the Better Business Bureau, was a consumer advocate, even though they were a business organization. And, of course, now I work in access technology for Cerotech. So where do you think you'll go? I mean, do you have any other interests?
I don't know. I love technology, as you probably can tell. I mean, conversations you and I have had off this is that I love technology. I love talking about latest whatever. I mean, I don't own an Android phone, but I love talking about it. I don't own an iPhone, but I love talking about it.
Well, production, right? You can maybe make some money doing audio production.
Yes, so
doing
that piece right there you heard, it actually did run. It does run at the top of the hour ID in KISS 95.1 Indonesia. It's actually running there. I just produced the pieces and sent it back out.
Right, so I think that I mention it because I think it's we're about to wrap up here. But I think that for blind folks, maybe not going on the air as we sought to do, there might be more work in just doing audio production and doing promos and on-hold messages and infomercials and tours of museums and, you know, different places, people that will pay you to provide audio guides. So I think there's a lot of work out there. And that
is
certainly a new vehicle that people can work from home. You can build a website, put up samples of your work. I think there's a lot of new opportunities that we can go into just in the audio production arena. But it is 10 p.m. Eastern, so I think this is a good time to put the wraps on Tech Chat 70. I thank everyone for listening, and we invite you to join us next week. We're going to do kind of the highlights of kind of some of the latest developments. We're going to talk about a lot of new news from everything from cell phones to AT companies to just a wealth of kind of what's lately been going on. And then we should have J.J. Meadow and Rick Harmon and Joe and myself and who knows who else will be joining us, or Mike Calvo maybe, to just kind of talk about what's going on. We're going to do it probably once every month, just kind of get you up to speed on the latest in access technology news so that you can make informed decisions. And, of course, in this forum, put in your two cents as well. So, with that, we're going to put the wraps. I thank you, Tate, for joining us this evening. I hope your information has been inspirational to the folks who are thinking about
Thanks,
it. Very good. Very welcome. So until we meet again next week, I invite all of you to stay connected and stay directed.
And as soon as we terminate...